HPPodCraft.com.
I remained a while at the top of the stair, but with the effect presently of understanding that when my visitor had gone, he had gone. Then I returned to my room. The foremost thing I saw there by the light of the candle I had left burning was that Flora's little bed was empty, and on this I caught my breath with all the terror that, 5 minutes earlier, I'd been able to resist. I dashed at the place in which I had left her lying, and over which, for the small silk counterpane and the sheets were disarranged, the white curtains had been deceivingly pulled forward. Then my step, to my unutterable relief, produced an answering sound. I perceived an agitation of the window blind, and the child, ducking down, emerged rosily from the other side of it. She stood there, in so much of her candour and so little of her nightgown, with her pink bare feet and the golden glow of her curls. She looked intensely grave, and I had never had such a sense of losing an advantage acquired, the thrill of which had just been so prodigious, as on my consciousness that she addressed me with a reproach. "You naughty, where have you been?"
"None of your damn business. Sometimes daddies need to go out, not be at home. Have a few drinks, maybe too many, but that's none of your affair. Stand down, child. Stand down."
That kid is tricky. That's like getting caught by your spouse in the act of having an affair at home and saying, "Hey, you naughty, shouldn't you be at work?" You know, just turning it around. But you and the neighbor, you're right here on the couch. "Hey, you know, I catch you playing hooky and now you want to change the subject? Sorry, I'm not going to let you obfuscate. Let's stick with the issue." No, Donald Sutherland, you don't have to leave. This hooky conversation has been a long time coming. You just stay there naked. It's not your fault. What are we reading?
Does it matter?
Not after that scenario.
That opening paragraph that we heard was from the 10th chapter of The Turn of the Screw by Henry James.
It's all part of our strange studies of strange stories here on HP Podcraft. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I am Chris Lackey.
Please identify today's reader.
That reader is the delightful Rachel Lackey. She reads lots of words on many days.
You know, Star Wars has the Force, but Star Trek has the Forced, and her name is Rachel. She's lighting up podcast screens all over the world on Rachel Watches Star Trek. We're about to do some quick catch-up on Turn of the Screw, but first, how about a quick catch-up on the podcast? What have you guys been up to on there?
We have been doing Next Generation. We're in the second season of it right now.
That's got to be a relief.
It's getting better. Not yet, though. We got some Plasky. Plasky is so data racist. It's the worst. She treats him like dirt. It is not cool at all. And Data's a little sweetheart, and she needs to step off. That's all I'm saying.
Like, all over the country, people don't want to celebrate Columbus Day. I would encourage the people of Illinois to stop celebrating Pulaski Day, given what Chris has just said. So can you tee us up on Turn of the Screw, please?
The story so far is that a woman we know only as the governess has taken a job at Bly Manor to take care of two children, Miles 10 and Flora 8. Her boss, their uncle, wants nothing to do with the children, so she's on her own. Besides the housekeeper, Mrs. Gross, and a whole slew of other servants that show up every so often, she is on her own. Recently, Miles has been expelled from school, but the governess doesn't know why. Both children are sweet and kind. Up to now, they have been. The governess has been seeing what seems to be the ghost of a former employee there, Mr. Quint, whom she just saw on the stairs in the middle of the night, right before the paragraph that we heard at the top. Yes. When she returned to her room, she found that Flora was not in her bed. A governess flips out and discovers Flora was hiding behind the curtains. The kid starts giving her the third degree, and that's where we are now. Flora is finally starting to get a bit creepy here. She's vaguely accusing the governess of something. What exactly? Just being out of bed? Not sure.
Yeah. It's really manipulative. Flora took advantage of the governess being gone to get out of bed and look out the window. That's, you know, to do what she wanted to do, but she's turned it around to make it look like she was looking for the governess in that action.
Yeah.
The governess says, "Well, you thought I was out on the grounds?" And Flora says, "Well, you know, I thought someone was." And then it says, "At that moment, in the state of my nerves, I absolutely believed she lied. And if I once more closed my eyes, it was before the dazzle of the three or four possible ways in which I might take this up." So again, that's the flow of the psychology I was talking about on the first episode. There are three or four things that went through my head at once. This narrative always, you know, kind of spills out along the decision trees we're constantly building in our brains. One thing she wants to do is just shake the kid and say, "I know you're lying." I liked these lines. It says, "Why not break out at her on the spot and have it all over? Give it to her straight in her lovely little lighted face." There was just something so derisive about that. And it's the first time you get an undercurrent of anger towards the children. You see, you know that you do and that you already quite suspect I believe it. Therefore, why not frankly confess it to me so that we may at least live with it together and learn perhaps in the strangeness of our fate where we are and what it means. She says if I could immediately have succumbed to it, I might have spared myself. Well, you'll see what. I found that kind of chilling, the way that that was phrased. The governess tries to wrest power away from Flora in that moment and says, why did you pull the curtain over the place to make me think you were still there? So she knows enough to say that, but then Flora goes, I didn't want to frighten you. This kid is good. She's been reading her Saki stories. She knows how to trick a guardian.
She sure does. The governess can't sleep that night, so she keeps looking around out in the halls, but she doesn't see Quint.
And that repeats itself nightly for a while because of these experiences. You know, she can't sleep very well. Similar to last week when she was looking in through the window, this is one of those things that from another perspective makes you think the governess might be the ghost. I mean, the way that she's just roaming through the halls endlessly in the middle of the night.
She does see a sad woman sitting at the bottom of the steps. But then she disappears, this woman. Most likely the also dead previous governess, Miss Chessel.
It says she was seated on one of the lower steps with her back presented to me, her body half bowed and her head in an attitude of woe in her hands. I had been there but an instant, however, when she vanished without looking round at me. I knew nonetheless exactly what dreadful face she had to show, and I wondered whether, if instead of being above I had been below, I should have had for going up the same nerve I had lately shown Quint. So remember, she didn't really feel fear when she confronted him. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was interesting that she caught the ghost in a private moment. That's a change. Mm-hmm. Up till that point, they've been looking somewhat malevolently at her. So Jessel's upset about something all on her own.
So after that, not much happens for a while. The governess is able to finally sleep. However, she is awakened at 1 a.m. and sees that her light is out. Mm-hmm. She's pretty sure Flora put it out and that she's out with the ghost of Jessel. She just thinks this. I'm not sure why she thinks it.
Yeah.
But that's where her brain goes. The governess goes into the darkness looking for Flora and finds her at a window.
With a curtain around her to hide herself. So she is being deceitful again. Because of that curtain being the blinds being around her, the governess is able to sneak out of the room without her noticing. And for a moment, she thinks about storming into the boy's room, which is just adjacent, looking through his window since it's right there. But she listens. It's totally quiet in there. He's asleep, she assumes. She doesn't want to scare him by launching into the room. So she figures the nearest open room is in one of these towers, actually, also very close. So she sneaks hurriedly into one of the towers, high above the gardens. It's a lower room in the towers, but it's above the gardens. She looks out the window to see what Flora is seeing. And you think she's going to see one of the apparitions out there.
But it's Miles. He's out on the lawn.
Zoinks! And then the chapter ends, a very cliffhanger cutaway. Jump ahead to the next day.
The kids are playing outside, supervised, like it's Alcatraz. And the governess tells Mrs. Gross that Miles was out late at night wandering around. She explains that she went to him and he came to her without saying anything. Walked right over to her and they walked into the house. She believes he was quiet because he was trying to formulate some sort of lie about why he was out there.
Yeah, and she didn't want to call out to him and wake people up, but she didn't need to. Says, as soon as I appeared in the moonlight, as you say, he had come to me straight as possible. So before we get into Clever Lying Kids Part 2, which is what this is, I found that this whole situation was blocked out in a really cool way. She wakes up, Flora's looking out the window. She goes to the tower to see what she's looking at. She's looking at Miles. Now, the fact that he sees her, I mean, this is stated explicitly later, but the fact that he sees the governess leads you to believe he wasn't looking back at Flora through the window. He was looking up at the tower. So probably right above the governess as she's standing there, Quint. I don't know. It's just a creepy situation. That revelation that as she's looking at him, he's looking at a ghost above her. But she got him back to his room.
She asked him directly why he was out there, and he said he wanted her to think that he was bad for once. Because he's always a little goody-two-shoes, and he wanted her to think he wasn't for some reason. Yeah. He stayed up reading and set the whole thing up with Flora to wake up the governess so that she would catch him out on the lawn where he wasn't supposed to be.
Right.
And when did you go down? At midnight. When I'm bad, I am bad, he says. She hugged him, and she wasn't angry about it. He was still a good kid, especially if this was his idea of doing something bad.
Right. You know, he probably, if he'd have seen Baby Geniuses 2, Super Babies, he would have seen Kahuna, who is the cool baby in there, and gotten a leather jacket and the sunglasses, and he wouldn't have had to pull this whole prank. But people need to understand this is a time when that movie wasn't available.
Course.
She thinks he's being deceitful. She says his answers rang out with a readiness. It was I who fell into the trap. She knows he's being manipulative, or she suspects it anyway. So when she's talking to Mrs. Gross about this, you know, finishing recounting what happened, she says she's really focused on something Miles said. It all lies in a half dozen words, words that really settle the matter. think you know what I might do, is what the boy said to her. Mm. He threw that off to show me how good he is. She says he knows down to the ground what he might do. That's what he gave him a taste of at school. And Mrs. Gross goes, Lord, do you change? I thought that was really funny because it was almost an outside perspective for a second of Mrs. Gross. Yeah. He's like, man, you came in here saying, there couldn't be anything wrong with these children. They're angels of sweetness and light. And then the next day, I think those are up to no good. You're like, whoa. Maybe Mrs. Gross is just kind of going along with everything because she's with a crazy person.
That is something that this story could definitely be. It could be about somebody that is not all there.
This quarter of it that we're covering today, I think, really strongly presents that notion.
Oh, yeah. The governess thinks that there's more to it than what Miles is presenting. It says, the more I've watched and waited, the more I felt that there was nothing else to make it sure it would be made so by the systematic silence of each. Never, by a slip of the tongue, have they so much alluded to either of their old friends any more than Miles has alluded to his expulsion. Oh yes, we may sit here and look at them. They may show off to us to their fill, but even while they pretend to be lost in a fairy tale, they're steeped in the vision of the dead restored. He's not reading to her, I declared. They're talking of them. They're talking of horrors.
Oof. She now sees all of the preternatural sweetness with, you know, she thinks, that seemed odd. It seemed preternatural because it was a put-on. It's doubt, capital letters, has crept in. And suddenly everything looks suspect. Like, hey, Donald Sutherland moved in next door and needs a cup of sugar. I'll be back in about 2 hours. You know, that seemed sweet once upon a time. But now everything is laced with this suspicion because you played hooky from work. What are you doing? You have a job. Mm-hmm. Stay at work.
She believes that the ghost of Quint and Jessel want to get them. And I wonder what that's supposed to mean.
I know.
Get them. Corrupt them? But corrupt them in what way? She says, for the love of all the evil that, in those dreadful days, the pair put into them, and to ply them with that evil still, to keep up the work of demons, is what brings the others back. Doesn't explain anything. Like, what
They're
evil...
They're dark-sided! They're dark-sided!
To do evil, you would have to, like, do evil, steal or kill or hurt people or be vindictive. What is going on here?
They gave her some dirty looks. Now the kids are going to give her some dirty looks and she can't let that happen. It's the work of demons. She sounds like a wackadoo Bible person in this scene. This part is about as close to a mythos story as the whole thing gets, I thought. It says, they don't know as yet quite how, but they're trying hard. She's talking about the ghosts trying to get to the children and destroy them. They're seen only across, as it were, and beyond, in strange places and on high places, the top of towers, the roof of houses, the outside of windows, the further edge of pools. But there's a deep design on either side to shorten the distance and overcome the obstacle. And the success of the tempters is only a question of time. They've only to keep to their suggestions of danger. So there's some kind of great old ones coming back into the world feel there. They know that they can cross. They don't know how yet. They're getting closer. She kind of Van Helsings these ghosts here and diagnoses what's going on with no evidence.
Yeah.
You know, she might as well be like, the only thing that will destroy them is true love's embrace and a silver dagger dipped in garlic. You know what? Because she's just coming up with the stuff out of nowhere.
Gross suggests that the uncle come and take the children away to get them out of the influence of Quint and Jessel. But the governess thinks that the uncle just think that she's insane. So Mrs. Gross says, well, maybe we can have him come here. But again, she's afraid that the uncle will think her weak, and she forbids Mrs. Gross to do anything like that. She says, if you should so lose your head as to appeal to him for me, I would leave on the spot both him and you. Do you think that the governess suspects that she might be seeing things and that's why she doesn't want the uncle there, or that it's just that ghosts are hard to prove?
If you just take it really credibly, ghosts are hard to prove. She's seeing this stuff. She knows it's true, but she knows she'll look like a fool upon examination because she can't produce these effects.
Yeah.
Also, she knows to protect herself if she is a crazy person. And she threatens. I mean, she doesn't threaten her job, but she does use her status as the head of the household to put Mrs. Gross, who's been her pretty kind confidant to this moment, she puts her under her thumb quickly here. It's almost like there's a parallel horror story for Mrs. Gross where she's being drawn into the web of this crazy governess. She has to indulge all of her insane stuff about the children for fear of losing her job. And she also wants to be there at the estate to protect them should this woman go crazy. And the thing about this that's interesting is it's the first time she's put Mrs. Gross under her thumb, although she has observed her illiteracy before. She seemed slightly uncomfortable with her station. almost like she's a little grossed out by her. There, I did it, brought it in. That's the meaning of the name. But this is the first time Mrs. Gross was actually maybe trying to manipulate her by saying, you know what the best solution would be? Bring the uncle here. But her plan is she hopes the uncle will show up, hear this crazy stuff, and fire the governess.
It seems that the governess believes that the kids know that she knows that they're talking to ghosts.
It says they had a delightful, endless appetite for passages in my own history to which I had again and again treated them. They were in possession of everything that had ever happened to me. Had had with every circumstance the story of my smallest adventures, and of those of my brothers and sisters, and of the cat and the dog, as well as the particulars of my father, of the furniture of our house, the conversation of old women in our village. So that's rule number one of controlling a conversation. Get people talking about themselves. They don't have time to think about what you're doing. If they're being indulged, most people aren't listened to in their lives. And so it's an easy way to quickly make friends. So, you know, if her suspicions are to be believed, they stored up and listened to and have all those details of her silly little stories, not because they were interested in her, but as a tactic that they've been employing and storing up for some time. And that's pretty insidious for kids to do something that's that intelligently manipulative.
Yeah, if that's what's actually going on.
That's what's happening.
Yeah. So the summer changes into autumn and there are no days of any incidences. She thinks that maybe her eyes were sealed and that the kids were doing ghost stuff right in front of her. Like, she's getting, sounds very paranoid at this point.
A few times she feels the sudden stillness that accompanies a visitation, but she never sees the ghosts. So that moment of where all the sound drops out that lets you know the ghosts are going to reveal themselves. It says, how can I retrace today the strange steps of my obsession? There were times of our being together when I would have been ready to swear that literally in my presence, they had visitors who were known and were welcome. And there is a little color on that incident with Miles looking up at the tower. I had beheld the boy over whose rest I watched and who had immediately brought in with him. Had straight away there turned it on me. The lovely upward look with which from the battlements above me, the hideous apparition of Quint had played. So that's a little more color in that he wasn't just looking up at the ghost. He was looking up lovingly at Quint.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she appeared, he turned that loving gaze on her. It's...
She's getting harsh with them. She says, they're here, you little wretches, and you can't deny it now. She doesn't actually say that, but that's what she's thinking.
Yeah.
For some reason, she won't confront them about it. That's something that's bizarre to me.
You know, I think, well, it plays in with your theory, because multiple times she says, you know, if I bring this up, it's real then. There's a space she's occupying, and it was a little the way that she deferred the decision to deal with school, where she says, if I don't address it, then it's not really happening. It's a very youthful thing to do.
The kids are acting as sweet as ever, very well behaved, but the governess thinks, again, this is still part of their ruse. She feels like she can't talk to the kids about Quint and Jessel. They have these long periods of silence where no one's talking, but the governess feels like they're all thinking about ghosts. Like everybody's thinking about, they're seeing the ghost, she's thinking about it, but nobody's talking about it. The children ask about their uncle. So she gets this idea for the kids to write their uncle as a type of educational exercise.
It says her biggest surprise from those days, in contrast to what you said a second ago, is that she didn't give in to hating the children. She still kept very patient. So I don't know what kind of psychological self-editorializing that is, but she's telling herself, man, you know what's crazy is that even while I thought they were lying little wretches, I never gave in to thinking they were lying little wretches. Wait a minute. Yes, you did. We saw it happen. But I was thinking, okay, we're in the back half of this book. We're heading to the last act. Screenwriting rules say something's going to intensify here. And once again, Henry James delivers. It says, relief arrived. I call it relief, though it was only the relief that a snap brings to a strain or the burst of a thunderstorm to a day of suffocation. It was at least change, and it came with a rush. Boom, into chapter 14. So kind of cool how he just seems to know, yep, this is the act change. Here we go.
So on Sunday morning, the governess and Miles are walking to church with Mrs. Gross and Flora ahead of them. Miles begins to bring up school and asks when he's going back.
It says, I now see how, with the word he spoke, the curtain rose on the last act of my dreadful drama. And the catastrophe was precipitated. When in the world, please, am I going back to school? The boy says. He fully calls out that we're entering the last act. I thought that was interesting.
So he calls her my dear. That's something you would usually say to somebody that you're intimate with or a child.
But these children all speak like
adults.
He's like a little gentleman. In fact, she comments how he's in this little gentleman's outfit and looks very much the adult.
He expresses his displeasure about always being around women. He brings up how good he's been, except for that night on the garden stroll that he did. And she plays it off like she doesn't even remember it, which kind of annoys him. She says, you won't do that again, of course. And he says, no, not that again. It was nothing, which feels a bit ominous to me. Him acknowledging like that thing that was like, oh, I'm being cheeky. He's aware that that's nothing. Whereas previously we felt like, oh, that was his idea of something bad and it's not bad at all. Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe.
Oh, what a cutie. He thinks midnight standing outside is bad.
Miles says that he wants to go back to school and he wants to be around his own sort, which makes the governess laugh. And she says, well, what about Flora? And that angers him because he's being compared to a baby girl.
She said, yeah, he doesn't like that. And he also, she says, well, don't you love, you know, don't you love Flora? And he says, if I didn't, and you too, if I didn't, whoa. She says, well, if you didn't, what? And he goes, well, you know what? Kind of storms into the church. A lot of that seems very, I mean, if you think about what's going on, if you take all the implications out, it's a little boy who kind of delicately was like, so can I go back and be around my peers? Because I want to play like little boy yeah. games and be around other dudes.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, you don't want to keep hanging out with your little sister? And he might not have some idea of a bad thing he's going to do, but just basically go, look, yeah, if you keep starving me for my peers and you keep me in a situation where I can't do mm-hmm. Little boy things, because the girl's not even his age, so it's not just her gender, it's also that.
Yeah,
I'm gonna act out. So there is a very commonplace explanation for this attitude.
Yeah, there is. So as they get to church, Miles asks what his uncle thinks about all this, but the governess honestly says that she thinks he doesn't care, to which Miles gets fired up and now has a mission to make his uncle come to Bly Manor. Now he goes on ahead to church, but she doesn't. She decides to go home.
Yeah, he's managed to figure out that she's uncomfortable with the school conversation. She says, Miles had got something out of me in that conversation, meaning that now he has that understanding. He's got another thing to leverage her with. Mm-hmm. If he brings it up, she's going to get uncomfortable. Everything is in these adversarial terms.
And she thinks that he's within his rights to say, clear up with my guardian the mystery of this interruption of my studies, or you cease to expect me to lead with you a life that's so unnatural for a boy.
So right, exactly what we were talking about. He's just like, and she goes, you know, he is within his rights. Either tell me why I can't go back to school or, you know, stop expecting me to not act out when you're doing this to me. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, so it turns out just ignoring the problem wasn't going to work for her.
Strange.
So she actually, it's funny because she goes, well, I was ignoring it and that's not working. What if I really ignore it? I mean, that's sort of her next tactic.
She considers quitting and leaving Bly Manor. Like, she's like, you know what? This is too much. I did not sign up for any of this craziness. She goes to the house and she sits on the bottom of the steps contemplating her situation.
I love how quickly, once you've let a thing like that enter your mind, suddenly now you think, well, I should just do it now. And that's what she's doing. Everybody's at church. They're not going to be back for an hour. I could end this. I could just end this. I could get all my stuff, go grab the chain. It'll take them a while to figure it out. Mm-hmm. That's what she's sitting there thinking about. I thought it was kind of, I was going, yeah, do it. Go. End the book.
And then she remembers that where she is sitting was the exact same place that she saw Jessel sitting that night months ago. So she gets freaked out by this and she goes up to the schoolroom. And then when she's there, she sees at the table Jessel. Jessel seems to be sad with her face in her hands. Jessel stands up, but not because the governess is there. She just doesn't seem to notice her presence. It says, dishonored and tragic, she was all before me. But even as I fixed and, for memory, secured it, the awful image passed away. Dark as midnight in her black dress, her haggard beauty and her unutterable woe, she had looked at me long enough to appear to say that her right to sit at my table was as good as mine to sit at hers. She thinks you terrible, miserable woman. So Mrs. Jessel gives her a look of understanding and vanishes. The room is empty and full of sunshine, and the governess, for some reason, this fills her with the obligation to stay at Bly Manor.
We'll have to circle back around to that scene because that must be significant in a way I'm not fully grasping. I did get the fact that she was sitting there bemoaning what she should do in this indecisive place. It's the exact place that Miss Jessel was in. Was that even Miss Jessel she saw? Because you didn't see the face. Was it herself that she saw? And then her coming up and Miss Jessel's writing this letter, which, you know, she says, oh, it must be a love letter to somebody or something. But she is in the process of this consideration of writing a letter herself to this uncle and asking him to come into the life. And I felt like in this scene, we're getting a sense of this repetition. Either she's seeing her own future or this is being repeated with each governess who comes here. There was something going on there.
Gross and the children return home from church and they aren't really weirded out that she ditched them. And this kind of hurts her feelings a bit. So she goes to Gross and asks if the children asked about me not being at church. Like, was that a big whoop or not? And she says, oh, yes, they asked me to say nothing and to please them so long as they were there. Of course, I promised.
She was disappointed they didn't notice, but they did notice. They were just trying to be polite. She says, well, I had to come back to meet a friend. And Mrs. Gross says, a friend? You? She says, oh, yes, I have a couple. I laughed. That seems like a real crazy scene to me. Yes, I have sure a couple. Because there's been nobody around this house except the ghosts you're talking about.
She expresses that the kids didn't want to upset her, and the governess says, but nonetheless, between Miles and me, it's now all out. All out? My companion stared. But what, miss? Everything. It doesn't matter. I've made up my mind. I've come home, my dear, I went on, for a talk with Miss Jessel. So Mrs. Gross wants to know what she's talking about, and the governess says some weird stuff. That Jessel, she suffers the torments of the lost, of the damned, and that's why, to share them, she wants Flora. Where is she getting all this from? Is this some
that's sort
of
telling you.
Psychic?
She looks straight crazy.
Or it could be, if it's supernatural, that she has some kind of sensitivity to the, to this sort of thing and intuits what's going on. But
yeah, well, look, I mean, if you're saying that she can see a dead person, then all right, we've taken that leap. It's no leap for me to think that that dead person expressed intent just by being there. So yeah, maybe she is just knowing this when she sees them.
She says that she wants to write the uncle, even if it angers him.
I'll put it before him, I went on inexorably, that I can't undertake to work the question on behalf of a child who's been expelled. For we've never in the least known what, Mrs. Gross declared. For wickedness. For what else? When he's so clever and beautiful and perfect, is he stupid? Is he untidy? Is he infirm? Is he ill-natured? He's exquisite. So it can only be that. And that would open up the whole thing. After all, I said, it's their uncle's fault. If he left here such people, he didn't really in the least know them. The fault's mine. She had turned quite pale. Well, you shan't suffer, I answered. The children shan't, she emphatically returned. I was silent a while. We looked at each other. Then what am I to tell him? You needn't tell him anything. I'll tell him. I measured this. Do you mean you're right? Remembering she couldn't, I caught myself up. How do you communicate? I tell the bailiff, he writes. And should you like him to write our story? My question had a sarcastic force that I had not fully intended, and it made her, after a moment, inconsequently break down. The tears were again in her eyes. Ah, oh, miss, you write. Well, tonight, I at last answered, and on this we separated.
And that's about as far as we'll go. We'll be concluding it in the next episode. You know, another thing that popped into my head just as we were discussing it was something I was kind of thinking about earlier, which is children are so pure and adults are so disgusting. That's in a nutshell what we learn in life. And so there is a layer of this, too, where I feel like the ghost of Quint and the ghost of Miss Jessel are just those children older. It's just that she's looking at the boy. That's why they went off by gender earlier. Uh-huh. That's why the ghosts are attached to the same kid, because it's almost like you're going to become this man. Like, we don't really know the governess's personal history so much.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Has she been really disappointed by people in her life, where she's looking at these kids and they're so sweet, pure, and innocent, and it hurts her because she knows it won't last.
Yeah.
When she sees those adult people coming for them, that's just the growing up. Yeah. And she doesn't want that to happen.
Yeah, that's something that's hard for me as a parent, that I know they're so sweet at this age and they're so protected from the outside world, that there's this, you know, like they'll cry about not getting this particular thing that they wanted. Like, that's something to cry about. And I, you know, like, it's just, it's insane to think, like, I could, if you gave me a piece of candy that I didn't want, that I would burst into tears over that. Like, I'm incapable. Yeah. I can't do that. And that I know that one day they're going to start to understand the horrors of existence and the world. They're not going to cry about getting the wrong piece of candy anymore. You know, they're going to cry about things that I cry about, the horrors that exist. That's a really good point about what you're talking about there. Maybe that is what this is about.
I think it's about all those things at once, which is why, you know, it's so heralded, this book.
Yeah.
Getting it, you know. Because, those kids are sweet and innocent, and then you flash forward to adulthood, and you're like, I don't know why. I gave him the sugar. We started talking. His eyes, the mustache, the fro. I fell in love with Donald Sutherland. It's against all reasonable. He's not my type. Not even my sexuality. I didn't know you were going to catch us like that. It seemed maybe that was, you know, explaining those things. That's adult. Yeah. That's an adult problem that you hope the kids never have to go go through.
Yeah. But that's the, man, that's the paradox of parenthood, is that that's your job. Obviously, I want them to grow up, because if they didn't, that would be terrible. They would, you know, they would be, they wouldn't be having a human experience. But also,
well, then you have that Interview with the Vampire Claudia situation, you know.
And that's the last thing I want. I want to thank our reader, Rachel Lackey, for knocking it out of the park again. She's so good. God bless
her. She's great. She's hilarious. Please tune into Rachel Watches Star Trek and get your fix, because that stuff is preposterous and people need to discuss it. And having someone come in with fresh eyes is so funny. So the premise still sustains. It's a great show. I also want to thank some patrons, and I'd like to start by thanking Riley Schreck.
I'd like to thank Kevin Summerfield.
I'd like to thank Chris Gertner.
I'd like to thank Sybil Lance.
Jill Z, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Joshua Strong.
Thank you, Kat Wilson.
I'd like to thank Barry Rathburn.
Moki Ayala, thank you.
I'd like to thank Meowfrau.
I'd like to thank Danny Cork.
And lastly, I'd like to thank Hellish Owl.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know we had listeners in the owl community.
Oh yeah, we're big in the owl community.
Sweet. I love it. Well, that's all we have for this. We're going to be back next week with the conclusion of The Turn of the Screw. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories
on HPPodcraft.com.
HPPodcraft.com.